This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
Now we come to chapter 2, verses 11 to 14. Paul and Peter at Antioch. First, the time. Some people believe that verses 11 to 14 describe an event that occurred before the events of chapter 2, verses 1 to 10. I would agree with those who would conclude from the order in which Paul addresses these matters that the confrontation in Antioch occurs after the first missionary journey. That is, during the time in Antioch, as described at the close of Acts chapter 14. Paul and Barnabas returned to Antioch after their journey, and they remained there many days. So at some time during this period, after the first missionary journey, before the Council of Jerusalem, Acts 15, Peter comes from Jerusalem to Antioch, and there he and Barnabas have their meeting. Think historically. If it occurs at the end of Acts 14, not only does it occur after the first missionary journey, but after what cataclysmic event in Peter's life? His visit to the house of Cornelius, as described at great length in Acts chapters 10 and 11. That's of extraordinary importance. Point two, the theology of Peter's action. His table fellowship with the Gentiles that started in the house of Cornelius was a visible counterpart to the gospel of grace. If you look at the Greek text of Galatians 2, verse 12, it describes an habitual practice of table fellowship. Before certain men came from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles, imperfect tense. And some have suggested that this was not just like a family night supper, that at the heart of the table fellowship was the celebration of Holy Communion, which lends a greater depth to what's going on here. Early Christians speaking of table fellowship are almost certainly including the Holy Communion. Some have suggested that the typical feast would have the saying over the bread and the saying over the cup as the beginning and the end of a communal meal, where the common and the holy were joined together without being confused with each other. Okay, so what's the theology of Peter's action? In withdrawing from the table fellowship, there's an eloquent, visible lesson, just as eloquent as the lesson when he originally established table fellowship with Gentiles. The theology was this: by withdrawing, he was saying to the Gentiles that something vital is lacking in their Christian experience. That for them to be accepted as full citizens in the church, they must submit to Jewish law. something vital is obviously lacking for him to withdraw from fellowship. It's as though to say his purity as a Jew is being profaned by that intimate table fellowship with Gentiles. Therefore, he is saying to the Gentiles, for you to be restored to fellowship with me, you have got to submit to Jewish food laws and all that they represent. Would you turn back to page 32 in your syllabus? At the illustration at the bottom of the page, three costly errors, none of which may be emphasized to the exclusion of the other two. One costly error was to exclude the Gentiles from God's covenantal blessings because of their failure to subscribe to one or more of those boundary markers, circumcision, the Sabbath, and the food laws. So here in Antioch, it's the food laws that are dominant. Thirdly, the psychology of Peter's action. We haven't gotten to Paul's response to this yet. The psychology of Peter's action. 3 points under that. To understand this, I would like to suggest that there were three groups in the Jerusalem church. I'm indebted to my friend Julius Scott, who teaches at Wheaton College grad school. He did his doctoral dissertation under F.F. Bruce on the Jerusalem church from AD 30 to AD 100. And he suggests that there was left wing, a center, and a right wing in the Jerusalem church. All these people are in Christ. You could find the same complexion in many a large American church. At the center stood the pillars, Peter, James, and John. On the left wing stood the Hellenists, including Stephen. You read that radical speech of Stephen in Acts chapter 7. And the Paul who opposed Stephen on that occasion later came to share his views, the radical effects of the coming of Messiah. Those would be the liberals. On the right wing were the Pharisaic believers. That's not an oxymoron. Pharisaic believers. Paul uses that very language. Excuse me, Luke uses that language in Acts 15. Listen to Acts 15, verse 1. Some men came down from Judea to Antioch and were teaching the brothers, unless you're circumcised according to the custom taught by Moses, you cannot be saved. Verse 5. Then some of the believers who belonged to the party of the Pharisees stood up and said, echoing verse 1. Okay, that's point A, to get a picture of the complexion of the Jerusalem church. Point B. I draw your attention to Galatians 2, verse 12. Before certain men came from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles, but when they arrived, he began to draw back and separate himself. I would suggest to you that the certain men from James are not themselves representatives of the right wing. They're representing the center, the pillars who want to keep peace in the mother church. So the pressure is being exerted from the right wing upon the center. And the right wing is identified here as the circumcision. The certain men from James are not themselves of the circumcision. They're representing the center because pressure is being exerted from the right wing upon the leadership in the mother church. And when the men come from James, we read, he began to draw back and separate himself, because he was afraid of those who belonged to the circumcision party. Some think that the circumcision party of the non-Christian Jews in Jerusalem, making life difficult for the Christian Jews. I'd rather say that these were conservative Jewish Christians from the Mother Church. May we not say that Peter's response to this pressure is akin to the response that brought about his denial of Jesus? He fears those of the circumcision, and he withdraws. And in so doing, he behaves out of accord with his theological convictions. Let him that is without sin cast the first stone. Many of our decisions are not based upon theological conviction, but psychological intimidation. He fears them. But it doesn't mean he has abandoned his theological position, as we'll see in a moment. Point C. Paul, on the contrary, confronts Peter. What is it that explains the difference between the Apostle Peter and the Apostle Paul on this occasion? I believe the key is found in Galatians 1, verse 10. Have a look. Am I now trying to win the approval of men or of God? Or am I trying to please men? If I were still trying to please men, I would not be a slave of Christ. Servant is an inadequate translation. Doulos is the word. I believe Paul writes Galatians 1:10 anticipating the writing of Galatians 2:11-14. He's a slave of Christ, and therefore he can be enslaved to no one else. Peter's action betrays lack of fidelity to slavery to Christ. He's enslaved, at least momentarily, to the circumcision party of the Church of Jerusalem. I quote to you Proverbs 29, verse 25. To be afraid of human beings is a snare. Whoever trusts in Yahweh is secure. Proverbs 29, verse 25. Okay, let's go to the body of the letter. Second main section, 2:15-5:12. We're going to look in a moment at the major proposition of Galatians. Let me just offer a brief preface before we get into the outline there. Look back at Galatians 2, verse 5. We did not give into them for a moment so that the truth of the gospel might remain with you. That phrase recurs in verse 14. When I saw that they were not acting in accord with the truth of the gospel, I confronted Peter. The phrase of 2:5, repeated in 2:14, prepares for an exposition of the truth of the gospel. Paul has not unpacked that phrase until he gets to 2:15. Richard Longnecker correctly says that Galatians 2:15-21 is the central theological affirmation of Galatians. Wonderful passage for you to memorize in English or Greek. Galatians 2:15-21 is the central affirmation of the letter. 2:15-21 is to Galatians what Romans 3:21-31 is to Romans. One other reflection before we turn to these verses themselves. There is no doubt that 2:15-21 are written in the light of the confrontation in Antioch. As a matter of fact, if you have the NIV, you will discover that the quotation marks continue to the end of chapter 2. I hope you understand what that means. Paul first addresses Peter in chapter 2, verse 14. You are a Jew, Verse 15, new paragraph, quotation marks, continuing on down, according to the NIV, verses 15 to 21 are a recording of what Paul said to Peter at Antioch. I don't think it matters whether you extend the direct quotation that far. What does matter is that the exposition of 2:15 to 21 is founded upon the confrontation in Antioch. You could put it this way. 2:14, the truth of the gospel, is unfolded in the verses to follow. Okay, now, the major proposition, 2:15 to 21. First, the nature of justification. Please turn to page 144. On page 48 of the syllabus, under A, where it says dikaiosune, active and relational, make a reference to page 144, Roman numeral 1, A and B. Page 144, Roman numeral 1, A and B. That's all under A, dikaiosune, active and relational. Turning to page 144. Dikaiosune in Greek and transliterated into English, from Greek to Hebrew. To understand righteousness in Paul, we must begin with the Hebraic, not the Hellenistic world of thought. For Paul's understanding of righteousness is deeply rooted in the Old Testament. In the Greek world, righteousness often denotes an ideal ethical norm. The idea of adhering to laws defining what is right and wrong is obviously not foreign to the Old Testament. But we must first recognize that tzedek and tzedakah are fundamentally active and relational, whether the terms are applied to Yahweh or to His people. God's command is righteous because God Himself is righteous. All His actions and all His relationships reveal His righteousness, that is, His faithfulness to what is right and just. Secondly, the covenantal framework. The righteousness of God is primarily His covenantal rule in fellowship with His people. A covenant is a bond in blood, sovereignly administered, says Palmer Robertson. By His sovereign initiative, Yahweh establishes and maintains His covenant with His people. Note how Genesis chapter 15, the chapter from which Paul quotes, both in Galatians 3 and in Romans 3, sets witnesses to the covenant as a bond in blood sovereignly administered. Yahweh is righteous in showing Himself utterly and consistently faithful to His covenant with His people. God's people become righteous through being rightly related to Him. Now go back to page 48 for a moment. Under B, justification, a judicial decision, make a reference to page 144, Roman numeral 1, section C, and page 145, Roman numeral 3. 1C and then 3. So go back to page 144. The legal context. Within the Old Testament covenantal framework, we observe the forensic character of righteousness. In His capacity as the righteous one, Yahweh is the judge of all the earth, of Israel and of all the Gentile nations. Yahweh makes judgments about persons and about nations, and He administers justice all in accordance with the righteousness of His own nature. This entails declaring persons guilty or not guilty according to how they have responded to His holy laws. Very often, Yahweh simultaneously condemns Israel's enemies and rescues Israel. Of special interest in view of Paul's teaching are the references in Isaiah 40 to 66 to manifestations of Yahweh's saving righteousness. And in those passages, righteousness and salvation stand parallel. Now go to page 145. Roman numeral 3 at the bottom. The verb dikaiō, to justify. In accord with the legal context, this verb always means to declare righteous, never to make righteous. The opening words of Romans 5 presupposes the formulations considered under 1 and 2. All three kinds of formulations must be taken into account for a full understanding of Paul's teaching about justification. Go back to page 48. Still under 1b, justification, a judicial decision. Make a reference to Galatians chapter 3, verse 6, which is a quotation of Genesis 15, verse 6, same verse quoted in Romans 4, verse 3. Now, make a reference to page 145, Roman numeral 2, section A. You've got a reference to Galatians 3, 6. In that connection, we're going to read page 145, Roman numeral 2, section A. Genesis 15, verse 6. Okay, go back to the top of page 145. Under the verb logizomai, brothers and sisters, there's no escaping the complexity of this. I apologize. Logizomai. Of the 40 instances of this verb in the New Testament, 34 occur in Paul, and 19 of these in Romans, and 11 of these in Romans 4. The quotation from Genesis 15:6, already found in Galatians 3:6, concludes, "It was reckoned to him for righteousness." The applicable meaning of logizomai, credit something to someone as something. From Romans 4, 5, and 9, we learn that it is faith, pistis, which is so credited. Not righteousness. That's paragraph B. This is a case of God's crediting to a person a quality that belongs to the person, just as sin is counted against a person where sin has actually occurred, or a wage is credited to a person's account where a debt is actually owed. Listen, Genesis 15:6, quoted in Romans 4:3 and Galatians 3:6, declares that faith is the response that Yahweh requires for being right with Him. It is precisely this response to God, that is, in relationship to God, that wins God's approval and secures Abraham's vindication. Says Charles Hodge, faith and not works secured Abraham's justification before God. On what grounds this occurred is taught elsewhere in Romans.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.